Yes, indeed. Here we are. The final podcast of the final book of the Gadget Trilogy. So with that in mind, I'm going to hand you over to my colleague, Paul O'Neill, who should be seated here.
Hello. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good evening, even.
How well, it's the podcast world's timeless, Paul. You should know that by now.
That's true. We're recording in the evening, so I thought I'd stick to the...
You're destroying the magic.
How are you today?
Fine. Well, I was fine until I came on and got to ask these ridiculously awkward questions, like, but...
Right, so we're here to talk about the third instalment of your the Gadget Trilogy, as you say, The Gunner, adding to Conor O'Brien and Mercer Ellis. So, yeah, we'll just get into it, I think. So I think the setup of this story is quite different, obviously, in comparison to the last two. Obviously, a lot of the main themes run through it, and it obviously contributes to wrapping up the plot, which is left on a bit of a cliffhanger in, at the end of Mercer Ellis. But it might not go in the direction initially that readers would expect. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, it was deliberate in the sense that I didn't want to be obvious, you know, to open the book. And, you know, there's a couple of things inspired me. One of the main things that inspired me, actually, was season 6 of The Sopranos, where Junior shoots Tony. And, you know, clearly, if you're a Sopranos fan and you're watching it the following week, you're desperate to find out what's happened. And we open up in the next episode where Tony, we think, is in some hotel room. And you're thinking, what on earth's happened here kind of thing? And, of course, it's David Chase brilliantly taking the viewer elsewhere. So I thought, you know, because I'd had a few sort of aims with this trilogy, and one of them was to, for every time the reader thinks, I know where this is going, to change tact kind of thing. So I thought that, you know, I'd kind of had the setup in mind, and I thought, I'll see how far I can go with this. And it was probably the most enjoyable to write out the three of them because, you know, the characters in this one particularly are very much based on real people. Indeed, some of them were even given their own names. Those were people who are no longer with us. And I'd kind of had these people in mind as I was writing the characters, and I thought, well, this could be like a nice tribute from me to actually go, I can bring you back to life, you know? And therefore, you know, it just was nice because, as you've probably seen in the book, these characters, I mean, they were real characters, you know, in every sense of the word. You know, I always find that one of the things that I sort of always got abuse for was if you had any kind of security in yourself or sort of were a bit gallus basically online, people hate that if you come from a working class background. Whereas everybody I knew growing up was like that, and everybody couldn't give a toss what anybody thought of them, because obviously that was in an era where they had snipers, you know, elsewhere around the world being able to fire pot shots at them. So that kind of aspect was very much in my mind writing this book three, in the sense that I want the reader to open that book and go, what the fuck's going on here? Have I got the right book here? And then gradually bring in the stories that needed concluded for book two.
I think that's quite evident when you're reading it as well. Like, obviously, I'd spoke to you, so I was a bit more aware. But when you do settle into it, it could be a completely standalone novel almost at the start.
I mean, the thing about that is, as well, is, you know, these are my stories, obviously, but you want people to read them and go, oh, I've been in that situation, or I know that kind of person, or, you know, whatever. And that's what kind of brings in people who might not know Edinburgh, or, you know, specific areas or pubs in Edinburgh. So I wanted to really paint a picture for these people. But as you've seen, as you say, and people might not realise, and when they read it and go, this is unbelievable, you know, this was the norm for these people. You know what I mean? One of them being right, you know, where sort of how to get in a pub when it's not actually open. In the process, he's sort of doing that, you know, particularly on Sunday mornings. And the way people talk to each other, you know, and address each other, you know, you have a character in the book going into the pub singing a, what many would deem a highly offensive song glorifying an IRA event, right? Now, that was just the norm for these kind of things. Nobody ran to the Daily Record or phoned the police, or clearly there wasn't any camera phones or anything like that. And like, that kind of incident wouldn't even be mentioned the next day. Far less, you know, whereas now I think we're all a wee bit so sensitive now and all that, that we really didn't have a, you know, and I found it myself in actual fact that when I was thinking back to these days and these kind of characters and these kind of pubs and so on, I was like, Jesus Christ, this is like, it's like an alien world almost.
Mm.
When you think about, you know, what you got away with then, just in terms of things like, you know, smoking in pubs and, you know, the drinking and, you know, landlords trying to pass you off water doing pints and all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, it's just, these things are just alien now to these people. So I wanted to sort of paint that world for people at the start so they knew this world and they knew what was kind of going on, and hopefully that they could, even if they can't relate to it, are kind of entertained by it, you know?
I do think reading it as well, like a lot of people who probably haven't set foot in a pub till maybe the 2000s, mm-hmm. might struggle to believe some of this stuff.
Aye.
I do think as well that I come from that area, so like I know what that pub was, mm-hmm. the pub in question, what it's based on, was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that was a big draw for you, sort of telling the real stories and real situations. But can you explain a wee bit about why, like, basing things on real events that might be perceived as far-fetched, like, and try to convince people that this is real? Does that say that appeal to you, that sort of tell people, I mean, that this stuff actually happened?
Yeah, I mean, so this generation, so we're in December 1990 now, and this is a generation after the sort of smack generation that engulfed Muirhouse in the 80s, and it was called the AIDS capital of Europe. We're into near the bevy and sort of hash-smoking generation. Ecstasy is on the scene, but it's not in pubs. It's in clubs and nightclubs and so on. And this was the generation that I kind of grew up in that respect. And as you say, there definitely are situations where people will be like, this has to be, you know, artistic license and that. But, you know, honestly, it's no. And, you know, I pretty much tried to base everything in this book on stuff that I'd experienced, heard about or whatever, just because to take the pleasure in people saying, that can't have been true, though, can it? And it's, no, it was. And here's what really happened and so on and so forth. Because when I used to see, when you're growing up in the Gunner and that's the place you're kind of drinking in and all that, this is a normal thing to you. And then the two or three occasions that I brought people into that pub, they just sort of sat there like a rabbit stuck in the headlights. What the fuck is going on here? Like, you know, and you're like, maybe this isn't quite the norm. And in actual fact, I'll tell you a story. This happened with some of the people who are in this book that are based on people in the book, stuff like that, right? Was that one of the people I know brought in a guy for his work one day, and he was like, because the guy was working in Muirhouse, and he said, I've always wanted to go, but I've never had the balls to go in. And he said, well, I'll take you in, don't worry about it, Ken. So he takes him in, they sit down, and one of the people that's in this book based on, it sat down beside them and literally tried to attack him within 15, 20 seconds.
Okay.
For absolutely no reason at all. No provocation or anything like that. And of course, it never happened, and the person who'd brought him in was able to take control of the situation and so on. But when things like that happened, you know, people kind of looked and then went, all right, and then that was it. You know, there was two or three, maybe even four or five occasions where I would be in there and I would see two guys sitting drinking with each other all night, and the next thing, one of them would be setting about the other one. You know, I mean, literally, you know, pure like fucking Ray Liotta and Goodfellas, you know, with the butt of the gun and that. And even before this era that's set in, you know, the bouncer, who you'll know name, you know, would basically tell you, right, that's it, out, Ken, like last orders. And if you waited like 15, 20 seconds, you'd just go over and smash your glasses. Get the fuck out now, I'll see them on. That's what he'd be like. And he would often get that drug, because he was basically, this bouncer was on £500 a week. This is in the late 80s, £500 a week and everything he could drink. So there was often nights when the disco was open where he'd be up with a microphone at the disco, he's fucking nut, and he's meant to be bouncing the place, you know what I mean? So, you know, there's loads of things like that would go on, loads of things would happen where, you know, I think I mentioned in the book, where you call watching points, where you're kind of sitting with your mates, or standing with your mates at the bar having a laugh and all that, but, you know, just a corner of your eye is on the rest of the boozer, just in case somebody erupts or something happens and so on and so forth. I mean, I actually seen, this is absolutely true, two attempted murders in there. One where somebody threw a pool ball at a guy that if I'd hit him on the head for the distance, he would have killed him. And another one when somebody walked up to a guy in the lounge at the bar, took him from behind and slit his throat. And the guy survived, but that was a mistaken identity.
I've heard of that story before, and I don't know. I always thought it was a bit like an urban myth. Like,
no, that's true. Well, I mean, I'll tell you right now, because I was sort of involved. The full story was the person came in, gone back 25, almost 30 years now. The person came in with a knife, and the person I was with said, "For fuck's sake, what are you doing?" Well, he said, "Oh, I'm looking for such and such." He said, "Look, give me that. You know, don't worry about it." He said, "Right, fine." The guy stayed in for about an hour and a half or something, had a few drinks, and he says to the guy I was with, "Right, I'll take that back now, I'm off." He even went back and he just took it off and walked straight up to the bar and slit the boy across the throat. It wasn't the right guy. So, you know, unfortunately, these kind of things happen. But again, it was like the norm, you know. Mm. And you certainly weren't reporting it to Mr. Policeman either.
You know, no, well, there's a bit in the book that sort of alludes to that. Nobody's a grass, isn't it?
Exactly.
He's coming for somebody.
Aye.
Well, obviously, not giving anything away, but they get no change. And it's,
No. And then that was based on a real incident as well, kind of, where basically they came in and everybody, not just one person, as in the book, everybody started doing the Dance of the Cuckoos, which is the Laurel and Hardy theme tune, as they came in. And you could see they were getting royalty fuck. But, you know, it's a squad full of nutcases in the boozer. So as much as they're two polis CID guys, you know, all it needs is, there's only one door in, one door out. All it needs is somebody to shut that door and they're in trouble, like, you know. So it was definitely, I never try to sort of glamorise that or anything, but there was a code of ethics among people then, especially that you just, the polis were, you know, you didn't even talk to them, never mind go to them, you know.
Do you think... Kind of track with you, but do you think how you'd feel now going into a pub like that compared to when you're young and sort of a bit wet behind the ears?
Well, in a funny way, I think that when you do encounter places like that, you've got to kind of walk tall. You know, you can't sort of just be a shrinking vial, or you're going to get gobbled up, because I've seen it happen to people in the Gunner. You know what I mean? So that kind of gives you the training. And the sort of... my experience and people's, like Hosey, who comes on our podcast as well, was we went into a situation where we were very young drinking, but our fathers and families were very well known in the area. So you'd get all of that kind of, "Oh, you're Jimmy Lafkins, laddie," and all that kind of thing. Ken, and, "Aye, Alan Hosey," right? When people of our age went in acting the goat and they never had that, they suffered for it. Do you know what I mean? There's quite a few guys I know I could tell you about right now, they've got a severe paste in, because they walk in, they think they're the big man because we're getting accepted. But the only reason we're getting accepted is our failures and families have built up a reputation over 20 and 30 years. "Oh, I know him, blah, blah, blah," and they'll look out for you and that kind of thing. Matter of fact, you know, one guy had a right go at me once when I was about 19, 20, and it was Hosey's uncle, Gordon, who just kind of came over and sat down beside me as if to say, you know, "That's the last you'll be messing with him," type thing.
You know, whereas, it's good. Sorry, I was just going to say, it's good to have that, obviously, inside, but do you think, did that ever hinder you as well, that you kind of had to live up to their reputations? Like, not live up, but kind of not come across like a dafty, sort of respect to them?
Aye, I suppose so. I mean, you know, it's never really, you know, I had an incident in the pub once. I was about 19. I was in the lounge, and it was a karaoke night, and so I was standing at this pillar near the front door, and this boy come in, he had a big scar on his face, and he basically said to me, right, get me a fucking bottle of Bex now. Okay, and that was it. And I was like, what? And he's like, fuck it. And I was like, what the fuck am I going to do here? And he was basically threatening me to get it, right? So I'm walking over, and as I was just about to hit the bar, somebody come through from the bar, another person that's in this book based on, and saw me ordering the bottle of Bex and went, what are you ordering that for? Because he drank Bex, funnily enough. And I said, I go, because you didn't normally drink Bex in here, Ken. I said, no, it's for such and such. And he went, oh, right. How do I, in fact, Ken, what? I'll take over him. And he just walked over and smashed it right across his face. And came back and was like, see your football last night then? Ken, it was just, that was, and again, I'm not kind of glamorising that or being all mental and that, but that's just what happened.
I drank it once or twice, right, before, like when I was 18, 19, and it wasn't quite the same in the pub in the terms of it was back then.
Mm.
But you did get that when there was any kind of trouble or that, it just went back to normality.
Aye.
At Winky and I, aye, like nothing had happened. And like I think you tell people about the kind of pubs, and people just almost automatically didn't believe you that it doesn't exist because they only go to places in the city centre and stuff.
One door in, one door out. I didn't care who you were. Every time you walked in, somebody walked in that door, no matter who you were, well known, whatever, everybody looked at you. Again, doesn't matter who you are. And hopefully, when you walk, it's kind of so and so, right? And then you'd pray to go to the bar and see somebody you knew. And the minute you started talking to him, everybody went back to normal again. And that was kind of one of the centre of the attention or that kind of thing. Mm. But aye, there was. It was such a sort of, you know, and that sort of, there was other forms of that as well in terms of, you know, sexual activity and that going on at different times or whatever, which isn't really in the book, actual instances yet, but in the pub, it's just becomes the norm, you know? And, you know, I seen one guy once, we left the Gunner and we went round to where the kebab shop, where the spa is now, kind of thing, in the middle shopping centre. And the woman went through the back and he literally leapt over the counter and tried to steal the till. This is at 2 o'clock in the morning, like, or 1 o'clock in the morning. And ended up going to court and all that for it. Because the woman gave him a right doing. Believe it or not. She came out with a hockey stick and started battering him with it. And I had to go to court as a witness and all that and pretend that he was just standing innocently in the shop and she started attacking him with a hockey stick again. And he got £150 fine. The police once come out and see that, he goes, that's the dearest fucking kebab you'll ever have, eh? But yeah, they kind of things just were unfortunately the norm. And another incident I'll never forget was we'd been at the Gunner and we went to this house party in Muirhouse Avenue a few years, right? Can't remember who took us here, but let's just say we weren't very welcome. There was an atmosphere, right? And then we were kind of very young, 18, 19. And we were kind of, you know, right, basically told to leave and all this sort of thing, okay? I mean, I could name the names of the folk, but it's all right, it's been sorted out since. So we went, like, what the fuck are we going to do? And there was two people at outside the Muirhouse Shopping Centre, right? This is Sunday night, I think. There was Jay Anderson, who we knew, was a good guy and, you know, could handle himself. And there was Matty, the glue sniffer, who used to terrorise the whole shopping centre, basically, sniffing glue and asking for 30 pence for the carry-out. And one of my mates once said to him, there's 60, get me one and all. And he went off his fucking head, eh? So we told him what had happened, and Jay, quite sensible, was like, well, let's fucking go back up there and tell these cunts, okay? And Matty's like, I'll come with you, right? And you get Matty's big, tall, strong boy. We get about 15, 20 feet for the place in Muirhouse Avenue coming up for the library side. And Matty took a run and jumped right through the kitchen fucking window, head first. So, that was a bit of a statement. You know? All hell broke loose after that. But it all eventually got calmed down. But it was, these things just became the norm, I'm afraid to say.
That's quite interesting that you talking there about guys that you knew that drank and stuff. Obviously, a lot of the characters in the book are either based on real people. In fact, most of them are based on real people.
Yeah.
Some have got their real names.
Mm-hmm.
See, when you're writing like that, about people who aren't like caricatures or fabrications, do you feel any kind of like added pressure because of that? Like in terms of either offending or about how much creative license you can take with stuff and whose boundary?
I had, because I said the real names of people are all people that have passed, so I spoke to all the members of their family or whoever. I've got to be honest, most of them struggled with what the fuck I was talking about. Like, say, I'm going to put such and such in this book, and the reaction for his sister was, but he's dead. Like, as if he needed to be alive to go in. But all the people that are no longer with us, that are in the book, not only were they great characters, they were great people as well. And they might not sound like that if I was to describe their kind of actions in real life and stuff, but they were. And they were absolutely forces of nature. And I just thought it was great. And it's something that I learned writing Celtic books, where I would be writing books about certain eras and I could talk about my old man and my uncle and people like that, and I thought, this is great. The reason I love this is because all my family's alive and, you know, they're no ill or anything like that, and it can put you in a nice wee space of just that happy place, I guess. And it was a similar kind of feeling with that. And also, quite frankly, you know, it was nice writing about an era where I was young, you know, and you have it kind of all in front of you, and you're literally living on your wits, you know, quite a lot of the time. But as I say, it's no all bad, you know. There's a thing. I'm no, obviously no spoiler, but there's an incident in the book with a young guy and an older woman, and that kind of thing was pretty prevalent. You know what I mean? It was you could get an education, shall we say, in that kind of environment. Like, you know what I mean? Because by that time, the woman had been round the block a few times and had realised that pretty much every company was a fucking nutcase. In fact, I actually had a particular thing where I seemed to always go after women that had some nutcase that was stalking them, you know, and I'd be like, you'd be with a girl and you'd have a good night and all that, and next day you'd be fucking full of yourself and fucking somebody would say, who's that I seen you walking up the roadway last night? You'd say, oh, it was so-and-so. What, so-and-so's bird? And I'd be like, oh, no, yeah. You know what I mean? Things like that. But, you know, it's a small area and all that kind of thing. And whatever anybody else thinks about things like that, I mean, it's still a community. I mean, it's still sort of your jollies right on your doorstep in terms of bevying and having a laugh and all that. And, of course, if, you know, partnerships and that come out, then so be it. But that was never really the intention. Although I did say to Jose, he was never a lounge guy. He was always in the bar, whereas I was always a lounge guy at the weekends. And I said to him, like, what did you think of people that were in the lounge and as opposed to the ones that stayed in the bar? And he was like, aye, they were all cunts on the pool. That was it, basically. I was like, all right, well, maybe you're right, actually. You know, but...
Well, that strikes me bizarre, but that is, was he not interested in that when he was young? Like,
probably not as much as I was, I'll say that.
It's quite interesting to talk about, like, people being good people and might, their actions might not say it in that, because there's a story in the book that I laughed at. It was when two of the characters were bumping a taxi fare and one of them nearly kills himself when they're running through the...
That was based on a real incident. We'd found ourselves back at a house party in Royston, Mains, and it was a middle of winter and it was freezing, and it was one of the ones where everybody was fucking steaming, like, really bad. And there was also the bizarre situation of the person who hosted the party. Mother was in her room, but she was very old and he cared for her, and she took tough stuff that just knocked her out. So he was like, make as much noise as you want. I'm not giving a fuck about the neighbours or anything like that, you know? So it was, when we left the party, we got a taxi phoned. You know, it was like a fucking engagement party where you're, you know, goodbye, all right, all the best, and shaking hands and cuddling and all this piss, and oh, I'll see you tomorrow, and all that fucking nonsense. And by the time we go out, can the time's nae fucking relevance to us at all. It was like £6 odds in the taxi, which is, you know, back in the '90s. Holy fucking shit. And the guy that I was with, so I'm not mentioning the character's name or that, just done the minute or if a ticky, that's gonna put a serious dent in my drink money for the moon, like. So he just basically about turned instantly as if he was facing me and going to attack me or something, and then just went, run like fuck, and ran. So I sprinted after him, and we were running through the dark, through the back green, and literally, it's pitch black, January, and he just disappeared. literally just disappeared, and I thought, what the fuck, you know, you're steaming and all the rest of it. And then I realised that he was in front of me, but he was beneath me. And what had basically happened is he'd ran straight into a washing line that was tight, solid, and bang, almost garroted him and fucking knocked him right off his feet like Ken. And so that was kind of, but it's that sort of, as you'll see when you read the book, tied in, as you mentioned earlier, about that comes back in the later in the story as to why that's so meaningful, kind of thing. And it's interesting in an area like that, I think these bonds are really important, because you do need people to look after you. You do need older people to kind of show you the way and stand in front of somebody who's going to attack you when you're still a young guy and whatever and stuff like that. And they're the ones that kind of show you the rules, you know? They're the ones that wrote half the fucking rules, quite frankly. So as that goes on, we just, it becomes fantastic. And me and this guy had some great times, but we were sort of daft as well, in the sense we used to do daft things like we'd be in the pub and it'd be quite busy, say a Friday, 6 o'clock or something, and we'd be standing at the bar and we would shout somebody's name that was sitting across the other end of the bar, then turn round as if we hadn't done it. And you'd see the guy looking up like, who the fuck was that, Ken? And then you'd go back and then he'd sit back down and take a drink of his pint and we'd go, George! And he'd be looking again and that, Ken. And we used to think things like that fucking hilarious. You know, it's not that funny, but it was just, you know, we were mental on that. And that's the thing, is that for all the nefarious kind of background to an area like Muirhouse and a pub like the Gunner and the characters that were in it, there were guys there that would stand in front of a fucking bullet for you. You know what I mean? And you know as well as anybody, in life now, they're very rare. Very rare. Somebody fucking drives you to the airport, it's a fucking story on Facebook for 2 weeks. Oh, that's really good, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas I think, that's, you know, you've got to basically say, well, and people will say to you, why did you drive him to the airport? Why did you get up in the morning? And you didn't want to say, well, he's my mate, and why wouldn't I? You have to go sort of go, oh, I'm old school, like, and didn't pay attention to me. You just stick to being an ignorant, selfish cunt, you know. but that's it. And the fun, you know, I wanted to bring the fun aspect as well, because obviously there was violence and all that sort of thing, and I'm not going to run away from that. But there was also some phenomenal nights, particularly when the new landlord took over and kind of professionalised the pub a wee bit and brought in acts and karaoke and discos and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, a lot of it was absolutely magical, quite frankly.
Little baby gun.
Aye, so you're talking about the dolly fun and that. So see, when you're writing the moments, like like the comedy ones, you're calling back to the funnier instances. Do you have a belief that it's going to be funny to a wider audience, or do you just trust that it makes you laugh and hope it does the same for other people? Do you think you know when you're going to a surefire winner by a joke or a story?
It's a good question, because I think you do, but then it also highlights that there are times where you probably haven't been, you know what I mean? I mean, sometimes, yourself included, I'll send out wee bits and blows to folk and say, what do you think of that, and all that kind of thing. And you'll never get... I could send the same paragraph out to 10 people, you'll never get the same reaction for anybody. It's amazing how people react to different things and all that kind of thing. And it is, and I found that as well when I was was touring films, right? Can you take a film somewhere one night and it'd be raucous and everybody'd be laughing at the bits you've wanted to be them laughing at, and then the next night you get nothing. And you're just, as Bill Hicks used to call it, it's like, you know, a dog getting shown a card trick. You know, you can never really tell with an audience reaction. But I think that what was good with Merciless was that people who I would say are avid readers and things like that, voracious readers, were coming back to me saying, oh, I love this bit and I love that line and all that kind of thing. And that's when you go, good, you know, because I've done it myself when I'm reading a book. Sometimes I'll read it and I'll probably not appreciate how funny that is or whatever. But with these kind of stuff, when it's real stuff, dialogue, real dialogue, you know, kind of street dialogue, gadget dialogue, if you like, a lot of these things might have been happened or said in different ways and been funny to a lot of people. And when I was doing kind of advanced higher English and that, my English teacher said to me, he said, your real strength is writing dialogue, you know, as in just back and forth stuff. And I've always had a kind of ear for that, you know, that if I was to say, right, I'm going to write about Paul O'Neill tonight, I could basically write and hear your voice, you know, as I'm writing it and the kind of things you'd say and stuff like that. So I always kind of think that places like Murus and the Gunner and that, it's a very dry, sarcastic sense of humour, but it's also a very in your face kind of, what the fuck are you doing now, you daft cunt, type thing, you know what I mean? People were not going to stand on ceremony, you know what I mean? And like, I can remember going out with a girl and trying to keep it really hush hush, and I went in the Gunner on a Monday night, never forget, playing a guy at Pool, Harry Brune. He takes his shot and he comes over and he walks past me and he says, oh, here you're sewing, you know, the lassie. Full bar hairs it, Ken. That's it. That's it. Finish straight away. You fucking no chance of keeping them in quiet and stuff like that. But that's just the kind of way it is. And it's a bit like a... It's a wee bit like the only the strongest survive, you know? And also, but it does shape you and it does... your character, and it allows you to do, it grants you the skills like being able to, you know, sense bullshit at 500 yards, know when somebody's trying to start trouble or about to start trouble or stuff like that, and also know when somebody's not quite being as truthful as they might be in a situation. And I know that can drive folk nuts because they're thinking, but I'm telling you this so I don't have to tell you the other thing. And you go, well, that's fine, but I fucking know it's not the full story, so it's up to you when you're going to tell it or no, you know? So it does arm you with a kind of survival skills as well. And I got a lot of my bullshit for there in the sense of chatting up women, you know, and just talking utter shite, thinking, ugh, when you're young, you know, tomorrow? Fucking hell, that's years away. But you know, I'll always come back to haunt you, basically, but it does... You know, you didn't realise it at the time, of course, but that's what it's doing. It's kind of, the socialisation of it is basically making you the person you are if you're of that kind of character, you know?
Do you think you're saying how it was always that kind of area, that kind of atmosphere when folk are always at the wind-up or sort of pushing people's butt, just as a laugh? Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever sort of take it, like, getting that relentlessly, like, some folk might just not be in the mood, if they ever snapped back... Did it end, like, was that tolerated, or was that kind of, if you kind of take that stuff, didn't it mean
that
much?
That, to be honest with you, that kind of thing was probably laughed at even more. If somebody was getting a pillar in and then they actually exploded, the probably even explosion of laughter would be even more. I mean, I remember one of the characters in this book said to me once that I was walking past the gunner, I wasn't going into it, and he was standing outside it having a fag, I think. And I said to him, I said, "Oh, you been in?" And he says, "Aye." And he went, "There's fuck all else to do around here, bar drink." And this is a guy in his 30s then, right? And I thought, he might have a point there. You know what I mean? There's no, can you say, there's no opportunity in Muirhaus. I mean, it's all gone now, but back then. But these people fought poverty and alienation and sometimes discrimination and lack of opportunity every day of their life. And I always admired the people who could still put a fucking funny angle on that. You know what I mean? And it was even to the extent where there was things that became the norm, which only mentioned in the book, by the way, I'm not spoiling anything. Everybody knew when everybody else was getting paid. Gyro, the book, disability, you know, that kind of thing. So-and-so be good for a tenner of the day type thing. When the landlord went on holiday, he left a list behind the bar of names and amounts of money behind them, and that was how much that person was allowed to borrow when he was away. So, but you think about it, it's a great way of keeping people in your pub, because that's what they're doing, they're spending their money in the pub, and then they're paying him it back when he comes back. But one time, I got a Lenny a tenner off of him, and was going, because I was going on a date in the ferry boat lounge on a Thursday night, right? It's about 1994. And that was that, no problem, all the rest of it, fine. Went back in the next game day, and he was sitting right at the back in the gunslinger seat with all the fucking boys round him. Here he comes now, eh? Fucking spending his money elsewhere, you dirty bastard. And every cunt's pissing himself laughing. So that's the thing, you know, like, I'm just waiting now. You're thinking he came where I am or anything like that. He knew where I was that night. He knew who I was with. Are you spending money that fucking, you know? And it's kind of half-hearted laughing. And the whole pub's there, but, you know, I've just got to sit there and take it for the next 2 fucking hours. And then what had happened was he'd actually won at the casino the night before, right? So he was buying everybody a drink. He'd won about 5 or 6 grand at the casino. And every time he would go to the, he says, are you wanting one, Paul, or are you going up to the fucking ferry boat? You know, and I just had to sit and take that all fucking day. Because, yes, it was humorous, but it was also a warning. Fucking do that again, basically, you know. And that's, I can see his point. Didn't get me wrong, I can see his point. But that's just, you know, if you for a shrinking violet with that type thing, you're better going to the Ducat, you know, or the Telford Dams or something like that, you know.
See, I noticed in this book, this novel as well, that I don't think football was as central to this one as it was to the first two novellas. It's weird to say that because a lot of the stuff is revolved around football, like a lot of the dialogue in that book, like the main character Jimmy being a Celtic fan and whatnot. But what, it's a bit off the thing, but what was it actually like in the Gunner in terms of football? Was it one-sided
Well, there's two aspects to it. I'll tell you something right now, actually. The first reason that I'd done that, and that there was an airy football around it, but there wasn't any in-your-face stuff, was pretty much based on our circle of people, where, you know, if Celtic beat Hearts, I'm not going to be able to say, "Ah, get it fucking up, you!" Ken, we just didn't do that kind of thing, because we ken the other person's hurting and all that kind of thing, and sort of, you know, whatever, and you give them their space. In terms of the Gunner, it was the banter was brilliant, but if it went beyond that, people were pulled back into line. And I'll give you a couple of examples. We'd go beat off Falkirk in the Scottish Cup in the 90s, I think it was 93, and I was like, oh, you know, here we go, I'm going to have to go back and face all this. Because obviously we weren't doing that well at the best times anyway. And I just went, fuck it. It was in February or something. I went in with a Celtic top on, right? It was a black and green striped one. I'll just take it kind of thing, right? So I'm getting abuse and right, all the rest of it. But there was one guy in particular who just never let it go. And he was a hun, like, yeah? I didn't really know the guy well or anything like that. And it went beyond football. It was fiending this, fiending that, blah, 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 blah. And a guy who people who listen to this might know, certainly known to us, with Alex Spence, just went and met berserk at the boy. He's like, right, that fucking lad, he's at fucking there every fucking week. What the fuck are you doing sitting here all fucking day? Fucking shut your fucking mouth. Now, Alex, like Joe Pesci, right? Small and all that. His nickname's Ferocious, right? And known him for years and all that. A good pal of Jose's and all that kind of thing. And he was like, he was ready to kill the boy. Came what I mean? Because of me. And then there was another one where a guy, Eric Hamilton, who's a big Celtic supporter, God rest him, he's dead now. And really good friends with his son Kevin and Paul and stuff like that. He brought a ghetto blaster into the gunner one day and was playing rebel songs just to wind folk up. No hassle. It's no that pub. Okay, people were listening, oh my God, this would be a riot in my pub. It's no that pipey pub. The banter is everything, you know? So this boy come up to him and says, I've got a tape here, the Orange Songs, can I put one on? And he went, I ain't bother. So everybody's like, oh, that's fucking sound. Boom, puts the sash on or whatever it might be. Fucking boom, that goes off. So then another two or three rebel songs go on. The boy goes back, can I put another song on? And Eric's like, get yourself a fucking arms, bastard. You know? And that's kind of what it was like. Similarly, I can remember so many times in the 90s when Hibs were, and Hearts were on that run. Mm-hmm. 22 games or whatever. And guys would be coming in on the Sunday after the game with a Hearts top on. Just standing there with the arms out like Scott Brown, you know, like fucking done it again type thing. You know, and if you get there, say, hey, fuck you, prick that. But it was all good natured stuff. Because everybody had their positions in the bar as well. Like, you know, everybody stood the same place every day. Mm. And you knew where people would be. And so if you turned round and you seen that base was empty, you'd be like, where's so and so? You know what I mean? And it's funny as well because there used to be a phone in the gunner and it was right next to the jukebox speakers. So these guys, just before the owner that I'm talking about took over, there was these three scaffolders took over the pub. So they saw it as a gold mine, right? And first day, the guy's like, why the fuck is a phone right next to the jukebox? Because you can't hear a fucking thing. So, of course, nobody really knows some of that. Don't know. Ah, fuck that, we're getting it changed. So next day, he gets a boy for BT to come in and put it right over the other side next to the doors on the dartboard, eh? Needless to say, 20 minutes later, phone box was gone. And you're like, that's the reason why it's not next to the door. You know what I mean? So a lot of these kind of norms and all that. But there was the football thing, loads of banter, absolutely tons of banter, and you had to give as good as you got. But I never really... One time, actually, mentioning Alex Spence, this was quite funny, I have to say. The day Hearts won the cup against Rangers in 98, I went to the Muriel's Chippy. If you remember, Big Kenny used to run the Chippy at the time, say like that. So we're talking about the game and all the rest of it, and wee Alec comes in. I was like, oh, right, Alec, I said, you'll be very happy today. He went, ah, fuck it, this is the first fucking trophy they've won since 1962. She's let them fucking sing and dance. I couldn't give a fuck, eh? Hibs daft, eh? So that was it. So I booked whatever it was out the chippy. Went home, you know, blah, 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 quiet night, whatever. And about 9:30 or something, I was like, fucking hell, I've ran out of fags. I'll run over to the chippy and get me in, eh? So I'm going all Cross Street with my old 2-seat Pennywell Grove into where the gunner is just to go to the chippy. And there's a fucking ambulance outside the gunner. And one boy's been carried in and he's been fucking, you know, had a severe doing. And there was a boy, Ronnie, standing there that I knew. I said, Ronnie, what's happening? He says, oh, we Alex Spence went fucking berserk. I went, what? I just seen him in the chippy and he was going home. He goes, aye, he came in for one pint and he was like, ah, aye, let them sing and dance. He said, that turned into 2 years later, fucking singing and dancing, eh? Yeah? And that was it. So, because the Gunner, it was always a Hibs pub. Plenty jambos in it, Ken, and knee hassle and all the rest of it. But it was always buses that ran, Hibs buses and stuff. And I always remember, actually, after 86, when Hearts lost the Scottish Cup to Aberdeen, literally an hour after the game, on the side of the Gunner next to the left-hand side of the door, there was Dons 3, Hearts 0.
That was in my whole childhood.
I
never got taken, didn't I?
Just, you know, and that was it, kind of thing. So, but aye, I mean, that was a football aspect, yeah.
more about the writing and stuff, like, a lot of the stories also about, as you say, young guys trying to make their way in a kind of an environment that's surrounded by folk that didn't suffer fools gladly, I guess. And you've said before that a lot of that's off your own experiences and stuff, right? So how does it feel to you to be writing about that? Does it feel cathartic, or does it feel almost like you're disconnected now that you're looking back at an era where, as you say, there's nothing down there anymore that forms part of the story? Everything's gone, feel like your childhood and stuff.
It's no cathartic, because I mean that for 99% I had a fucking great time, you know. I do feel disconnected to it now because, as you say, it's all gone, and most of the people are gone. And it can often be like, God, that did happen, eh? And, you know, and then you think about the incident and stuff like that. It's nice to kind of wallow in that nostalgia, you know, and take a walk back there and all that kind of thing. And it's also nice to put people in situations and go, right, how would they react to this? Or, you know... I mean, there's an incident where, I don't know if you remember it, where, and this is kind of based on a combination of incidents, where a guy comes into the character Jimmy and starts bumming up Celtic and fuck these Hibs cunts and all that kind of thing. And Jimmy's like, shut up, you know, again, because I'll get away with that, but you'll know, you know, that kind of thing. That was my experience of three or four guys coming in and being the big man, and I'm like, you're in the wrong place for that kind of thing, okay? So it's good, but it's also like, that's what I have in my head, you know, the Gunner and Pennyville Guards, Pay Road and that kind of thing. You know yourself, you go there now, it's all gone, there's shops and new houses and all that kind of stuff, and so that world's gone, you know, but I've tried to kind of preserve it in these books, in the sense that, you know, whether I like it or no, the Gunner pub shaped a huge part of my life, and having said that, I was still glad to get out of it because, you know, unfortunately, people who stay in it all the time don't live that long, really. You know, occasionally they do, but unfortunately, a lot of these people that I mentioned probably died when they were 50 or something like that, and it was brutal. You know what I mean? So, as much as I loved the place at the time, it certainly wasn't a place to spend my whole life in. But it's always fun writing about it, and remembering stuff, and you know, thinking about things that people who play big parts in the novella did, and go, I'm going to write about this, and you're probably going to hear it, but you know, this did fucking happen, and stuff like that, and the people that know these people, I think, will recognise them. I never tried to hide them or be too kind of subtle, you know, particularly the wee Harry character, obviously. That's the easiest character I've ever written, because I could still contact that person and just say, what do you think about this? And get the reaction and just write it. Exactly, because they have never had any growth whatsoever, basically.
See, that's an aspect of it as well, though. Like, so you talk about it being like guys didn't live till that long, there all the time. It was kind of like did have moments like violence and stuff. It was quite well known for that and stuff. Do you think there's an element of sort of like looking back at it through rose tinted glasses because you were young and it's all you had at that time? Like, as you say, the guy says to you, there's fuck all else to do around here. So you kind of got sucked into that, and you look back as that was your upbringing. Or do you think it was genuinely a time that you really did enjoy when it shaped you and stuff?
I mean, I definitely did enjoy it a lot, especially when I never really had much confidence as a young person on the basis of having, you know, Perthes disease and calipers and all that kind of thing, and nobody really played football till I was in primary five, and getting mocked by a lot of people for being a cripple and all this kind of stuff. And I kind of thought that the only way to counteract that was to act the goat a wee bit, you know, and create a persona when I was 12, 13, 14. But then, of course, what I realised when we started drinking in pubs was alcohol makes that confidence for you. And suddenly I could talk to people and chat women up and, you know, be in the pool team and all that kind of thing. And that was all drink fueled, you know what I mean? Now, fortunately, drink never got a grip of me like it did with some people and suddenly make me into an alcoholic, basically, you know what I mean? But in terms of the rose-tinted stuff, you know, most of the times I had in there was great. Some of them, obviously, weren't they? Some people were complete and utter dicks. And there's no getting away for that. Some people were bullies and all that. But for a spell, I mean, the pub should be, especially a working class community, pub's the heart of your community. You know what I mean? And it was quite funny because I saw a thing when in the paper when they were demolishing the actual Gunner, which was only 2 years ago or something. And there was all these comments underneath basically saying, good riddance, good riddance, good riddance, good riddance, fuck yous, it's the best thing ever happened. Offy women. And that's clearly my experience because they lost their husbands to that pub or their boyfriends or their faders or whatever. No, I didn't mean passed on, but just the amount of time they spent in there. Because women were only prevalent behind the bar and when it was a disco or a karaoke. Can you very rarely saw them just come into the bar or that kind of thing, you know? So it was a different time, you know, it was a different time. So I suppose for a lot of people's experiences, they're going to all not be that great, but I think I was fortunate, Hosey as well, to be in it at a time where it was in its pomp, when it had changed ownership, and whatever anybody thought of the owner, he did run a professional pub, and he was the sort of person who could, because you know what happens in a pub like that is when you get a new owner, it's like the Wild West, because all the fucking bams come back that have been barred for years, and then one by one, you need to be able to sort that out, and if you can't handle that, you're going to get swallowed up, and he can handle that, you know, he can handle himself as well as anybody I ever saw. So, you know, it was great. You know, I remember Christmas Eves and parties and all that, absolutely phenomenal. You know, I was like, fucking hell, man. I mean, I remember going into that party, trying, you know, sort of half dating this lassie and worrying about what was going to happen and how can I do this and say this. About 18, 19. And by the end of the night, I think I'd kissed about 5 different women saying Happy Christmas. You know, and I was like, fucking hell, that was our Playboy mansion, you know?
One bit of the novella I like was, I think Getting Anything Away, is basically, you kind of refer to it as like an instance where a main character, grows into a bit of a white guy, like a bit of a gadget,
mm-hmm.
and it's a callback to an earlier bit in the story. Like it's the same line, and the earlier in the story is maybe a bit green.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about like how you write characters like that and how it's evolved? Your writing's evolved in terms of that, in terms of showing character growth like that.
I mean, it's an attempt at being cinematic, because how I would imagine that scene is, as you say, this is a coming age moment for that character, would be to have the hustle and bustle of the pub all around him and the music and the noise and whatever, but the camera would be right on him, you know, stood still, looking at the other person,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's sort of, I think as a writer, you get better every more you do, it's as simple as that. It's not like music where you have that difficult second album syndrome. You more you do it, the more you do it, and this is, I've been doing it. You know, I've finished this book, obviously. I'm doing another one, and then that's going to be me for about 2 years because I've written so much in the last year and a half that it's like, right, I need a break. But, there were aspects of that where I was finding it easier and thinking, God almighty, where's all this coming through, like, where that's going to fit in with that earlier on, that kind of thing. And it just comes through practice. It's really that simple. And it was kind of based on something real, but it's very pleasing when you get the kind of things and you think, oh, I've written that earlier and this is going to slide in there perfectly, like, you know, that's always really fulfilling, and you just hope that people, when they read it, they get it, you know what I mean, and that's why, as I said, people, as you said, refer to right at the start of the podcast, are going to be surprised when they open it and go, what's this? You know, mm-hmm. and it's like pursue it, you know. And I had that with Connolly Rising, where, you know, when the first chapter, I beg your pardon, describes graphically a sexual proclivity. I had about 15 people say, write to me and go, what's going on there? And when you explained it to them, they were like, oh my God, you know, they just didn't quite sink in what was actually happening to them, you know. So hopefully with the theme that I've created, because I'll tell you right now that basically my aims with these books was first and foremost to get the people that buy my stuff to be reading again. You know, people in my circle reading again. So I make them novella size, you know, easy to read, blah, 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 blah. The second thing was I had a conversation with a guy I know, David Harper, who does a formatting for the books about Factory Records. And Factory Records never got anything right, really, right? But they constantly put out content, you know? And everything got a number. They got a rip for an ex-producer that got a number in the Factory catalogue, you know, that kind of thing. And their aspect was always like of, you know, nothing else matters, just the content. It doesn't matter what fucking else goes out. And that was a big kind of thing in that. And the last one was literally to, as I said to you before, present an image of Edinburgh that people might not understand, where it's not about tourists or tartan shite or junkies or anything like that. It's about different sexy people, and I think I've covered the sexy people in the three books that I wanted to, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think that takes me into kind of my final question is, overall, through the three novellas, there's obviously some serious themes running through it, like about religion, politics, mm-hmm. and stuff, people thinking they're maybe better than others and things like that, but if I had to describe the main thing that I took away from it, it was probably about young people finding out who they are, discovering a new phase in their lives and at a time when the world's changing.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, I guess, is taking the twofold. Would you say that's a fair takeaway for the reading? And if no, or in addition, what are the themes that you want readers to take away from the trilogy?
I think that's fair. I think that one of the basic aspects is about the changing aspect of just the world and different worlds within the big picture world. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That they're changing. I think I definitely wanted to change the perception, as I said. And I think particularly in the last book, I tried a theme of not everything you believe is true.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That there are perceived perceptions about things and stuff that people just believe forever. And they might not necessarily be true. You know? And that's something that's happening quite a lot now, in terms of the, you know, things that are being released from files and all that kind of thing. You slap a documentary on Netflix and the thing you believe forever and ever about some story actually wasn't true. You know, and so I wanted to kind of put that into a kind of 1990 aspect of it, so that people, just to people, basically see people, look, stop and think. Then you just assume that everything you're reading or listening to or watching is true. Be the guy or the girl that says, wait a minute, you know? Because that's one of our best weapons as working class people. And I like the aspects of working class people that do stand up and do fight for themselves, you know, and kind of, for example, the miners' strike, you know, a better example. I was watching this thing about the Toxteth riots in 1981. And this guy says, I'll tell you why the riots, and this was a guy who was on the ground at the time, he said, tell you why the riots happened. He said, they took riot because of the extreme poverty, the lack of social mobility, the complete lack of opportunity, and people being sick of being pushed around by the police, right? Bring that all onto the battlefield in Toxteth and Liverpool, the police sent a massive squad in to shut them all up. And what happened? 1,000 police got injured that night. 1,000 fucking police. And the guy was like, well, we had all these guys for St. Helens. What does everybody know about their rugby league? They were at the front, you know? And they basically annihilated the police that night, right? And now, I'm not advocating violence, but what I'm saying is, threat should always be there for people. See, listen, if you fucking keep pushing us around, we're going to react. I think that's been lost in society now. You know, we have these fucking scumbags in government, crooks, who are stoking up racism, they're fucking killing the poor, their fucking freedom shite with lockdowns and all the rest of it is based on nothing but their own economic fucking issues and that kind of thing. And I'm basically saying to people, you know, particularly in last week, if you're working class and you feel like you've got all this kind of things, fight back. Stand up. You know, didn't shut your door on your neighbour, didn't turn the other cheek, because now is the most important time in history, I think, for this kind of thing, because we should always have that one aspect against the rich and powerful, is that they put their fucking forces on us, we'll fight back, you know? And that's what I was kind of taught by a lot of these people in the Gunner, which was, we didn't give a fuck if we were in poverty and all the rest of it. We're no fucking worse than any cunt, and there's nobody better than us. And so that was kind of the aspects as well. So I like writing about working class people and that. I'm a working class and proud person. And I would hope that people who are working class would relate to it. And if anybody middle or upper class reads it, I very much doubt, then they might get a better understanding of what we're like and know just the kind of benefits Britain shite you see on the telly and the demonisation of people who, you know, get 26 grand a year in housing benefit in London, and people go, oh my God, that's fucking terrible. Why, it is terrible, because you couldn't get a fucking garden shed for 26 grand a year in London, you know what I mean? Changing these aspects and having fun.
Excellent. So that's kind of me done for the question. I'd just like to say that when somebody asks you to read the, like, novellas like this, the worry is that you might not like them, and it's somebody that you're close to. But I genuinely really enjoyed all three of them. I thought it tied together well. I think this part of the trilogy is maybe a bit more subtle in terms of the overall story, but I thought it tied it together really well. Anybody listening, I'd encourage you to buy it, definitely.
Well, thank you. And as I say, this primarily is just you know, a day in the life of these people, so hopefully you'll enjoy it. I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was on the house of love. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look. Having read the book, I'd love to turn you.
Seconds flat. Found my way upstairs and had a smoke. And somebody spoke and I went into a dream. cheer. And though the halls were rather small, they had to count them all. Now they know how many holes it takes to fill the Albert Hall.